We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Feel like Kobe in the fourth quarter. This is the Dane Moore NBA podcast brought to you by Blue Wire Podcasts, and I wanted to slide a show in here in the lead up to training camp, which is somehow less than 2 weeks away. It's just going to be me on today's show, and there's three things I want to hit on. One, obviously, from the title, you know we'll hit on a little Ben Simmons. We've really peppered the Simmons trade possibilities like up and down in the pod over the summer, so if you want real specific trade stuff, go back and listen to those. If Simmons were to come, I want to focus on what, on today's show, what it would look like defensively if Simmons were in the fold. So that's where we're going to be going, which is really just a way of talking about the Wolves defense as a whole. And secondly, related to that, that's going to kind of lead into a couple of questions I asked Timberwolves' new defensive coordinator, Elston Turner, about his vision for the Wolves defense when he spoke to the media on Monday. So I'll drop in those clips from Turner. He's pretty open about the way he thinks about defensive schemes, so if you care about the Timberwolves defense, which I think you should, if you have hopes of this squad being a playoff team, then I think you'll find it interesting what Turner had to say about what the defense is going to look like. And then lastly, we'll talk a little bit about the re-signings of Jared Vanderbilt, Jordan McLaughlin. Those contracts were reported Friday night, and I think the price tags came in at team-friendly rates, you know, quite frankly, a lot cheaper than I thought they would. So we'll talk about where that kind of puts the Wolves financially, how that relates to Ben Simmons, hint it doesn't. And yeah, we'll get into what those signings might indicate in terms of how this team shakes out more rotationally. I think that was more indicative by the signings. So we'll start with Ben Simmons. And again, we talked a lot about potential Simmons trades this summer. My stance remains that the package, if it were to happen, would be far more, you know, would be far more than what I see getting tossed around online, maybe by Timberwolves fans. I think it's both true that Daryl Morey is not going to get what he's asking for, but that the price will also maybe be more than what I'm seeing. I get emails and stuff where people are being like, hey, would this work? Here's this trade for Ben Simmons with none of the Wolves' best players. Like, that's not going to happen. I think the trade conversation starts with the conversation of multiple lightly protected or perhaps unprotected first-round picks from the Wolves. Also likely the inclusion of Jaden McDaniels, and then the inclusion of two of these four players, Malik Beasley, Taurean Prince, Patrick Beverley, D'Angelo Russell. Here we go. We're talking about the trade. pairing two of Beasley, Prince, and Beverley allows for clean salary matching. And then, as we talked about, having Russell in there, which I don't think Rosas wants to do, having Russell in there with one of those guys, that makes it so Philadelphia would, you know, need to reroute money. It guarantees the inclusion of a third team. It gets more complicated. But even in the clean salary matching option, I mean, there still probably has to be a third team. Just because Philly's going to want to bring back a player who is individually at a higher level than Beasley, Prince, or Beverly are, right? So that's not what we're talking about today, though. We're talking about the defense. Like I said, we in the media had the chance to talk to new Wolves D coordinator Elston Turner on Monday, and it just got me thinking about the defense. And so here we are in September, and it's like, oh, Ben Simmons, talk to the coach. I'm interested about the defense. So I just started thinking about and taking some notes on what I think, you know, what this team would look like if Ben Simmons, you know, was part of it defensively. And it doesn't really matter what the Wolves would run schematically. If Ben Simmons was on it, he could fit great into any defensive scheme. He's just that good defensively. I mean, given Simmons's tools, you can play him in a variety of different defensive roles, and you know, you're going to find success. And it really, he'd be the best defender Karl Anthony Towns has ever played with. I think maybe by a wide margin. Obviously, you know, shout out KG, but was KG like 39 when he played with Cat? One knee. I mean, other than that, right? The other best defensive player Cat's played with is Jimmy Butler, and I think Jimmy is probably, or at least for me, when I was thinking about this, like Jimmy's the best facsimile for Simmons as a defender. If we're trying to kind of picture how this would look like on the floor, you know, we think about the typical kind of construct of any Wolves defense over the years. And, you know, you kind of have Cat drop back at the rim. You have someone at the point of attack guarding the ball. And then you have the other two wings that we say they're kind of in the tag position, at least in pick and roll coverage. Like we saw with Jimmy, you can put Simmons at the point of attack, or you can put him on the wing in that tag spot. Jimmy's very good at both of those things. You know, he can shut down the ball. He's really active hands, and he's smart on the wing. The difference I see with Simmons compared to Jimmy in that role is just mostly related to his size. I mean, Simmons doesn't give up anything athletically, but he's even better at guarding the ball at the point of attack because he's just way taller, way longer, and more athletic than Butler is. And that size is valuable when Simmons is off ball as well, right? Like, when Simmons is in that tag role, he can use his size to kind of like... Simmons, oddly, he kind of defends like very upright, which he doesn't really get burned for because he's very quick. But when he swarms the ball, he is just so long. And I think when he's coming in there in those spots, this limits the ball handler's ability to drive. And it limits the ball handler's ability to kick the ball out to the three-point shooter. When you have Simmons coming in there, kind of converging on the play, it's hard to score against him. And the other area Simmons' size is valuable is you can put him in the power forward spot defensively, right? Like, if the opposing power forward is in the corner, right, spotted up for a corner three, you know, Simmons has the length and speed to really be a help defender all the way into the lane while also having the ability to get back out to the corner and recover to that. And if the power forward is in the dunker spot, you know, more of a maybe bigger player, more athletic player, that's not going to be a mismatch for Simmons either, right? Physically, that's very different than when Robert Covington was in that role next to Cat, or Jaden McDaniels when he played in that role next to Cat. Not that those guys are bad defenders, but you know, Simmons weighs like 40 or 50 more pounds than Covington and McDaniels do. I think like in this role, the thing to envision is Giannis. You know, Giannis is elite in that power forward role defensively. The Bucks use, right, they use Brook Lopez as the drop big at the rim, like the Wolves use Cat. And then Giannis is kind of in that free safety role. He kind of ranges from the dunker spot to the corner. Now, Giannis he's better at it than Simmons is. But Simmons can play that role, and that's my point. Jimmy Butler can't play that role. So if you're thinking about how the Wolves were bad defensively the Butler year, like, oh, well, if the Wolves trade for Ben Simmons, are they even going to be better defensively? Like, my answer is yes. I know when Jimmy Butler was here, they ranked 27th, but I think it would be wrong to say that Simmons can't do more things than Butler can defensively. He's certainly more versatile, and he's versatile all the way up to being able to guard fours, maybe even fives. And I would argue that he's better on ball and as a help defender than Butler is. I mean, Butler's a hell of a defender, but I mean, Simmons up and down is... he's kind of as good as it gets defensively outside of the center position. Now, Butler's obviously a better offensive player than Simmons is. That's why I think if we're doing our ESPN top 100 list of like best players in the league, that's why Jimmy Butler is going to be ahead of him there. But if we're talking about defensive impact, you know, it would be almost impossible for me to see the Wolves, you know, being a below average defensive team if Simmons was in the mix. I don't see that 27th happening again. And even anywhere in the middle there. And that's why when I think about whether or not it's, you know, like quote unquote worth it to pay up a hefty price for Simmons in a trade, this is what I go back to, is that defensive impact, specifically within the construct of the Wolves roster. right? I mean, obviously the counterpoint is that Simmons isn't going to have that same impact on the offensive side of the ball. And I hear that. That's true. I just go back to, like, what do the Wolves need more? Even trading a Malik Beasley and or a D'Angelo Russell in the trade, it's not like the Wolves become a bad offensive team by losing them. I mean, remember, the Wolves are a walking top 10 offense any season Cat is healthy. And Ben Simmons is not going to hurt that. The Wolves don't walk into like a Draymond Green problem like the Warriors do of having two non-shooters if they acquire Simmons. Like, yeah, I mean, maybe it'll be problematic to like play Simmons next to Josh Okogie, but is Okogie like in the rotation? I mean, Jared Vanderbilt, maybe, but Vanderbilt's not going to be starting if they trade for Simmons. You just don't. The Wolves have plenty of shooting to put around Ben Simmons if they trade for him, even if they do trade a couple of shooters in the process of acquiring him. And I know we're talking about defense here, but I think that highlights how the defensive value of Simmons would provide almost all profit. And again, it's not like Simmons is some zero on offense either. So, yes, I'm about it. I think Simmons would have a profound impact on this team. I also understand that price matters. It's not just a no-brainer to add Simmons at the cost of McDaniels and Beasley and numerous valuable picks. Like, it's not. You obviously don't do any of Morey's crazy demands, but there's certainly a logic based on what I believe the impact of Simmons would be on the defense, you know, to pay up and consider that McDaniels, Beasley, other filler plus numerous unprotected picks. I mean, I think if you believe in the defensive impact, like I think you believe that that's a fair price tag. With or without Simmons, though, a huge question entering the Timberwolves season is, you know, how tactically they're going to deploy their defense, right? Like, we operate this one bubble of the, like, oh, Simmons happens, like, that's its own thing. But back here in more likely reality, you know, it's a huge question of, like, how are the Wolves going to guard this year? We know last year, once Finch took over, and he's even said it, like, it was basically just a lot of guess and check defensively. You know, for that reason, I don't think the defensive film is all that instructive. I don't think the defensive numbers are all that instructive, even the good ones. Like, they entered this offseason needing to hire a new defensive coordinator, and that coach needed to work with Finch to put together a defensive plan. It seemed like they were on their way there with Joseph Blair. That was step one. Obviously, then they race, go back, and now back at step one, they hire Elston Turner from Houston to run the defense. And on Monday afternoon, we got the chance to ask Turner a couple questions. And I think for me, it's starting to begin to clarify what this defense is going to look like. Again, like I said, Turner was really open. So we'll get to those questions with Turner here after a quick break.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk. But it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink. Which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, we're back talking about what the Timberwolves defense might look like this season. Yes, defense isn't exactly a sexy topic, but those of you who have followed this team at all over the past few years know that this side of the ball is the biggest missing puzzle piece. It's why the Timberwolves are almost always bad. The Wolves have only been a top 10 defense one time in the past 25 years, which is a random stat that isn't relevant to this roster, but a stat that is relevant to this roster is the fact that they've been a bottom 10 defense every year of Cat's career. And so with that, you know, we're not only trying to find the missing puzzle piece, we're trying to figure out, like, what shape even is the piece, right? For all 6 years of Cat's career, and, you know, we've been over this plenty, but from Sam Mitchell to Tom Thibodeau to Ryan Saunders, like, the Wolves have used Cat not only exclusively as a center, but as a drop coverage five whose main job is defending the rim. And along those lines, all three of those coaches have ran pretty similar defensive schemes. You know, we use probably too much. We use drop coverage as a very broad way of describing how those coaches have used Cat. You know, drop is specific to, that's a specific pick and roll coverage, but the way you defend pick and rolls is typically indicative of how aggressive of a defensive team you are. And to that end, the Wolves have ran very conservative defensive scheme. They've been a conservative defensive team since Cat has been here. You know, drop coverage is like, it's like a running formation in football where you have like a tight end, maybe two tight ends and a fullback out there rather than having like three or four wide receivers, right? Like that scheme can work in football. Your running back just better be able to run the ball, right? And as always, you know, that's always been relatively unclear with Cat. Like, can he run the ball? He's had extended flashes where he looks like a good rim protector, but those good flashes are often tied to having like talented defenders around him, or at least like the same people, some continuity. But, you know, back to football thing, Cat can run the ball. He just kind of needs like, right? He needs like an offensive line. He's not getting you 100 yards no matter what. So I think for me, that was the big question this summer, you know. How were they going to deploy Cat defensively next season? Part of that question could have been answered by signing or trading for a true rim defender to play next to Cat, right? That didn't happen, the whole Miles Turner idea. So the question then becomes, you know, how are they going to deploy Cat specifically as the rim protector? And I thought we received a pretty big hint in early August that this season might signal a pretty big change in that vein. Joseph Blair, who is no longer with the team, he was initially named the defensive coordinator, and he gave me this answer in early August that I thought was very indicative that the Wolves' very conservative drop scheme might be up for a change.
Defensively, in your experience, when drop coverage is working in the NBA, why is it working?
Because you have a massive individual in that drop coverage. It's hard to pass around to get past. That's what I've noticed. You know, I can tell you that from my time with the Sixers. We ran drop a lot with Joel Embiid, but when we were in that same drop coverage with Al Horford, it wasn't nearly as effective. So it wasn't that the coverage changed, it's the person in the coverage. So I believe that you have to kind of defend to your personnel. And if you have a big, massive individual that has really good hands, drop coverage is pretty good.
Again, that's the guy who was going to be the defensive coordinator. And what he's describing there is not liking the defensive philosophy that, you know, the Wolves ran under Ryan Saunders and David Vanderpool, you know, unless you have a Joel Embiid-sized player. And Cat is far closer in size to Al Horford than he is to Joel Embiid. I mean, that's just a fact. I know Cat's listed at 7 feet tall. Cat's not 7 feet tall. And he's certainly nowhere near as tall, long, and thick as Joel Embiid is. You know, you factor in that Cat on Instagram certainly appears to have thinned down a lot this summer. And, you know, I think it's just, it's at least clear that Cat is not a massive individual by NBA standards. So it seemed like along those lines, we were destined for a schematic shift, right? That's what it sounded like with Blair. But then Blair leaves for the Wizards like 3 days after giving that quote. So the question becomes, well, all right, like, what will the next defensive coordinator think? Will that defensive coordinator be more Blair or will he be more Vanderpool? And I'll let you be the judge of what Elston Turner said on this topic. But my read on Turner's commentary on Monday was that he feels that his feel of the personnel will determine exactly what he does, but that the plan is to keep Cat back at the rim. It is to run drop, you know, perhaps a scheme that's a little less conservative, you know, maybe call it like one tight end, but still drop coverage. Here's what Turner had to say when I asked him about his ideas on the scheme for next season.
Which you mentioned with with needing to kind of come and see the group first before determining, you know, what you're going to run schematically and such with this group, it seemed like when you were in Houston that the coverages seemed very tied to the roster. Once Capella left, obviously you guys started playing a lot smaller, and that led to a defensive change. Do you have an idea in that same sort of way of what this roster looks like and what, just by looking at the roster, what the defensive scheme might look like?
Well, I mean, I do, but not definite, not definite, you know, on paper and on the outside looking in. Obviously, you want to keep a guy as big as Cat around the basket to improve rebounding, to get in the way and be an interferer of shots at the basket. You don't have to block it, just interfere it, make him shoot it over, you know. So keeping him as close around the basket as you can. Now, with today's game, a lot of guys, a lot of centers are three-point shooters. And, you know, you have to go along with that. But as a general system, my thoughts are to try to keep them around the basket. But we did a lot of switching in Houston. And those type of coverages have – there's a lot of benefits in doing that. And there's also some not so good benefits in doing it. So, you know, the main thing is we want to try to keep our bodies in front of the ball, contain the dribble, fill in and help each other where it's needed. But in terms of where we're going to switch, how we're going to switch, if we're going to switch, those are yet to be determined. But now I've been around long enough to have taught every coverage, you know, jumping, trapping pick and rolls, to going under pick and rolls, to switching them last year. And you know, you mentioned the small ball. We were trying to be active defensively, create turnovers, run out, and get early baskets. That was our goal. So we went to small ball, but that, I think that has a place at certain times during the game in special situations, not the whole game where teams know that you're a small ball team. You know, put it in there 3-4 minutes if you put it in there at all. But my opinion that you know, that with big guys like Cat and the rest of the roster, you know, we have to put them in, use what their gift is, and that's size.
So I think my main takeaways from that are obviously the part about trying to keep Cat around the basket as much as they can, right? Like, again, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It depends on, you know, how conservative it is around Cat, how they surround Cat, all those things. But I do think we pretty clearly know that Turner won't be leaning into like a chaotic scheme that is heavy on switching, right? Because like you said, there's downsides to switching, which is true. The frequency of how often, you know, they switch, like you said, is to be determined. But the last part of Turner's answer is what stood out to me. And it's what most deviates from what Blair's view was on the team. And that's that it appears Turner views the Wolves' size as a weapon, or at least not as a problem. And for me, I'll be curious to see if Turner changes his opinion on that. You know, my theory, just going off of what I've witnessed through the past few coaches that have been here, is that initially Cat is viewed as a lot bigger of a player than he is, or that he might play bigger than he actually does. And that most coaches kind of use him in a big way as that being the smart tactic initially, but then they kind of begin to pivot off that or pivot off their belief in that. You know, regardless of whether or not Cat is more Horford size or Embiid size, he does play smaller. Even if he is kind of tall, Cat is not an extremely physical player. I think you come to realize that after watching him up close, you know, game after game. And to that end, that's why I think Blair was wanting to go in a different direction schematically. You know, I don't know if everybody knows this, but Blair was on Saunders' staff last year, and he worked with the big guys, and he witnessed Towns night in and night out last year in that big spot. And I think from that experience, Blair deemed that Cat would maybe be best utilized as a big who relies more on finesse than he does on pure size, which isn't even a knock on Cat. Like, there's different ways you can be a center and effective. Turner, for now, or at least it sounds, seems to believe a little more in Cat's size than maybe Blair did. So we're kind of back to square one here, if that's true, right? If Turner's going to use Cat as a drop big in a conservative, somewhat conservative scheme, you know, how do they make that work? Which led me to just ask Turner the same question I asked Joseph Blair back in August about, you know, if drop coverage works, when does it work?
In the NBA today, just generally, not maybe Timberwolves specific, when drop coverage is working, why is it working?
Well, when you factor in the scouting reports on other teams, it depends on what they are trying to do. Most three-point shooting teams want to do that. They want to shoot threes. And so your coverage is to go over. You stay attached to the ball. You never loosen up, and you make them go over the screen. And when you do that, they head downhill to the drop man. Downhill meaning toward the basket. So you've taken away the three-point shot. That's the first goal succeeded. In order to do that, also, you know, the big man has to be agile, because now you have a on-ball defender who's probably behind the basketball, and you have a basketball coming right at your center toward the basket. It's a liability there. If your center is the main threat offensively, you're risking foul trouble with a good ball handler coming right at him. You know, so there's pros and cons to every coverage, and we just have to weigh it out. But downhill coverage takes when you drop, it takes away the three. And also, you know, it does keep your big man closer to the basket.
From that answer, it seems like Turner believes in situational drop coverage. And from some people I've talked to, I know that Turner was a big fan of playing drop with Clint Capella when they had Capella in Houston. That's because, you know, Capella was a very agile big. Capella could handle the ball handlers going directly downhill at him. Which the interesting line in there, though, right, was about the big difference between Capella and Towns is that, you know, it being a liability to put your center in drop coverage when they're the focal point of your offense on the other side of the floor, right, because of foul trouble. Capella obviously was not a focal point of the Houston offense. Cat obviously is a focal point of the Wolves offense. And we know Cat has struggled with foul trouble throughout his career, so I think this checks out. You know, if Capella happened to get in foul trouble in Houston, it's like, all right, like, on to the next. I mean, Capella didn't even play really full starter minutes when he was there. I mean, but the opposite is true in Minnesota. You know, we've seen it. If Cat gets in foul trouble, like, the whole thing crumbles. Certainly the offense crumbles. So the sense I get from all of this is that, yes, the Wolves are going to run their coverages similar to how they've always run them with Cat. But I think the difference is that Turner will not be as dogmatic with how they do it, which is the opposite of what happened under Saunders and Vantepoel, right? It was like, keep pounding the rock, like, believe in it, solid is enough. Under those two, the Wolves ran a dogmatically conservative defensive scheme that often put Cat by the rim, often through drop coverage. Under Turner, and through conversations I've had with Chris Finch, I'd be very surprised if the Wolves' defensive coverage is not diverse this year. And I think those quotes from Turner are the first kind of indication that they are going to be diverse, but all the way on the spectrum. I mean, I think we will see some switching, but I also think it will go all the way to the other side of the spectrum, where it will be conservative at times as well in drop coverage. So there you go. I tricked you into defensive coverage talk by putting Ben Simmons' name in the title of the show. Let's wrap up today's pod by talking about Jared Vanderbilt and Jordan McLaughlin. They both re-signed with the Wolves this week or last week, however you want to put that. 3-year deals for both of them. 3-year deals that are really 2-year deals, if you want them to be. Vanderbilt's third year is only partially guaranteed, and the third year for McLaughlin is a team option. So really, these are like 3-year deals, the same way that Wancho's contract last summer was a 3-year deal. Like, it's only 3 years if it works out, right? You can guarantee that third year. And speaking of Wancho, that was kind of my worst case scenario with this summer's negotiations with Vanderbilt. Like, I'd heard last summer that the Wolves had a walkaway number with Hernan Gomez that was ultimately lower than what he signed for. But, you know, last minute, the Wolves did boost their offer up to $7 million a year. And, you know, Wancho's back. And I think there was reason to be concerned that that might happen this summer with Vanderbilt, you know, last minute boosting Vanderbilt's number up to $7 million a year too, which is, I know what Vanderbilt's initial request was in the negotiation process. Now, I don't mean that to compare Vanderbilt to Hernan Gomez as players necessarily. Obviously, they're very different and quite frankly, it would be an insult to Vanderbilt and how well he played this season to compare him to what Wancher did last year. But the concern I had with Vanderbilt is more just about the idea this summer of if they would have signed him to a $7 million a year contract for multiple years. Again, which is similar to what happened with Wancho. Like, it looked like he deserved, like Wancho looked like he deserved to get $7 million after getting traded for, but then he looked like a minimum player after his role got diminished. And while, like, Vanderbilt is for sure valuable in the context of the Wolves' current roster, I mean, he's probably going to be the starting power forward, right? I just wonder if in a year from now that the Wolves might add another power forward, right? Moving Vanderbilt to a bench role. And then now it's kind of that same role diminishment sort of thing. And at that point, if the Wolves had caved and played Vanderbilt, you know, $7 million a year, that $7 million, you know, feels, I think it, next summer, that would feel like it was in the way of making other moves. Again, just like Wanchus did. But it's not a $7 million a year contract for Vanderbilt, which is why, like, my concerns about that are removed, and it's why I view this now as a win. It's a $4.3 million deal this year, $4.6 next year, $4.9 non-guaranteed in the third year. And at that price tag, like, Vanderbilt is probably a bargain for the role he'll play this year, and still a fine price for a backup if the team does add a power forward, you know, a year from now or sometime during the season. You know, I'm here with Britt and some other guests. We talked about how Vanderbilt's price tag would probably be tied to, like, how good teams ultimately view him defensively, right? We talked about how Vanderbilt graded out as 98th percentile in as a defender last season, according to defensive effective plus minus, which is a pretty good catch-all defensive metric. The question I think for teams, including the Wolves, assessing how much they would want to pay Vanderbilt was about how much that metric is overvaluing Vanderbilt as a defender. I mean, we know that 98th percentile for Vanderbilt is hyperbolic, right? Vanderbilt is a good defender, but he's not a top 10 defender in the league. That's what that metric implies, right? So I think the question became, like, is Vanderbilt closer to 98th percentile defensively or 58th percentile defensively? I think we can all agree it's in that range, right? So for another team to have come out and offered Vanderbilt a contract for that $7 million a year or something like that, that would have been them, I think, asserting that they think Vando is more 98th percentile than he is 58th percentile. But that didn't happen. And I would say that this, you know, this $4.3 million number the Wolves ultimately got him for, it's more indicative of that 58th percentile. So I think if you're listening to this and you would take the over, if you're like, dang, you know, 58th, he's way better than that. Like, well, then all I'm saying is I think you got a profit on this deal. You got a good value for the Wolves. And that's all before even considering the need the Wolves roster has at power forward. I'm not saying Vanderbilt is some sort of, like, savior at power forward, but he's the only one, right? I do this. It would have been really problematic for the growth of this team if Jaden McDaniels and Torian Prince had been the only power forwards on your roster this year. I mean, we know size next to Cat is valuable. We know this team struggled to rebound. And Vando provides way more size and way more rebounding than those other guys do. So all in all, I am pleasantly surprised by the price tag for Vanderbilt and for the team-friendly nature of the contract on top of that. Not to mention this number being only 4.3, you know, that allowed the Wolves to bring back Jordan McLaughlin without going into the luxury tax. Which brings us to J-Mac. And honestly, like, surprised me when this one came through. I know there were conversations in the Wolves front office after making that Patrick Beverley trade that, you know, the downside they viewed of making the move was that it probably would prevent them from bringing McLaughlin back. And that was downside because they knew they had this nice contract offer out there for McLaughlin, like 3 years, $6 million or $6.5 million. Like, that's an asset for your team, or maybe even in a trade, like, down the line, if McLaughlin proves to produce at a backup point guard level. I mean, the way I think about it, and I tweeted this out the other day, is, you know, I've known about this $2 million number for McLaughlin for a while, so I'd started thinking about it, and I'm like, all right, so you have McLaughlin for $2 million, you got D'Lo for $30 million. Like, if your whole point guard rotation is $32 million, that's not too bad at the position. I know that's kind of maybe not the perfect way to think about it, but, like, if you don't have any other money committed to the position, I think that $2 million from J-Mac kind of blunts a little of the $30 million that D'Lo's getting. A lot of teams, like, pay their point guards way more than that, their backup point guards, right? Like, Monte Morris, DeLon Wright, Tyus Jones, TJ McConnell, DJ Augustin. Like, that's, like, the the normal backup point guard. And those guys make like $7, $8, $9 million a year. And, you know, some teams pay the backups even more than that. Like, obviously, Ricky Rubio, $18 million. Goran Dragic, $19 million. Eric Bledsoe, $18 million. Those sort of deals are out there for backup point guards too. And I mean, are those players better than Jordan McLaughlin? Yes, but like for the dollar, you know, probably not. To be fair, you know, Patrick Beverley falls into that like Rubio, Dragic, Bledsoe kind of thing. He's set to make $14.3 million this year. To be clear, I'm not like anti-Beverley at all. I think it was a major win to trade Jarrett Culver and Juancho Hernangómez for Patrick Beverley. But now, like in the context of the point guard position, the Wolves had $46 million dedicated just to the point guard position this year between D'Lo, Beverley, and McLaughlin, right? Like, which again is fine to get Beverley. The opportunity cost was just Culver and Juancho, even if those guys were sunk cost, whatever. Still, $46 million is too much at the point guard position given how pinched the Wolves are, which I guess what I'm saying is that I like the idea of D'Lo and J-Mac being the point guards a year from now once Beverley is off the books. If Beverley doesn't want to resign, I think you have a manageable number at point guard between just Russell and McLaughlin. And as we learned this summer, like, you need every dollar. The way this roster is built up against the tax, like, you want to improve this roster on the margins, like, that's going to make a difference. That said, like, I don't think McLaughlin is some... I don't want to overblow the McLaughlin things. Like, he has to be more consistent. He really fell off as a scorer last season, you know, specifically around the rim. I think we all saw that last year. He struggled to finish. I saw Wolves clips on Twitter posted that McLaughlin shot 60% within 4 feet of the hoop his rookie year, and that number dropped all the way down to 45% last year. It's a big difference. Looking into that a little bit, like, not being able to finish around the rim really hurt McLaughlin as a pick and roll player last year, which is kind of his bread and butter, right? Like, of the 150 players to shoot out of pick and rolls 85 times last year, McLaughlin's effectiveness per possession ranked 144th. That's really bad. But if you go back a year to his rookie year and you look again at the 150 highest volume pick and roll shooters, McLaughlin ranked 38th. That was the same effectiveness as Donovan Mitchell, Jordan Clarkson. So I think the hope, and if you want to play McLaughlin in your rotation and, you know, not hurt your team, I mean, the hope is that he at least has to be somewhere between his effectiveness as a scorer out of pick and roll and around the rim needs to be somewhere between those 2 years. You hope it gets all the way back up to where it was his rookie year. The good news, though, is that McLaughlin last year became an even better passer in those pick and roll situations. Those other numbers, like I was just saying, like, those are just pick and rolls where he goes to the rim and shoots it, right? As a passer, McLaughlin generated 1.08 points per possession as a pick-and-roll passer, which was a sizable jump, actually, from his rookie year, and it's just a good number overall. I think we can all, like, picture that, right? Remember McLaughlin, Naz Reid, and pick-and-roll? You know, consistently hitting Naz on the roll with that pocket pass. And for that reason, like, Naz had a great year as a pick-and-roll player. Naz generated 1.16 points per possession. That's really good. That's the same effectiveness as Giannis Antetokounmpo and Jared Allen last year. And Naz, it's not a small sample size either. Naz actually ran more total pick and rolls than both Giannis and Jared Allen, which is just kind of nuts. So again, not a small sample size. Crazy stat here while I'm on the Naz train. Only 9 players in the entire NBA shot out of pick and roll situations more than Naz Reid did last season. Not per game, not per minute, total shots, which is wild considering Naz only played 19 minutes a game last year. And the other of those guys are playing like 30, 35 minutes, right? Point being, Jordan McLaughlin had a lot to do with that. So I'm encouraged that J-Mac is back. I think he's a good backup point guard. And I think, you know, I'm surprised they got him to not only sign for so cheap, but for so long, right? It's guaranteed 2 years at $2 million this year, $2.2 million the next year, and then a team option on the third year for $2.3 million. Like, that's basically a minimum contract, but with team optionality. Like, obviously, McLaughlin has some things to prove about his effectiveness and, you know, how good is he even in meaningful games? Like, same thing goes with Vanderbilt. We've seen these guys play in, like, the functional equivalent of the garbage time part of the season where the Wolves have been, like, well out of the playoff hunt. That's where these guys have produced. Can they produce when you're in the playoff hunt, when you're 500 in January? Like, you know, we got to see. But also, like, Vanderbilt, I think the price tag, whatever that risk is, like, the price tag is worth that risk for McLaughlin too. I think it was a really good job of patience by the Wolves front office and the whole negotiation process. Like, for sure, props there. And no, when I get this question all the time, no, I don't think signing Jared Vanderbilt and Jordan McLaughlin has any impact on the Wolves' ability to sign Ben Simmons. Like, yes, now they're even closer pushed up against the luxury tax. The Wolves currently sit $600,000 below the tax with 14 players under contract. But they were going up against the tax anyway, had to fill out those roster spots one way or the other. So if a Ben Simmons trade was going to push them into the luxury tax, that was going to happen with or without re-signing Fando and J-Max. So don't fret there. And one last thing before I let you go, the 14 players I include in that where they're $600K below the tax includes Leandro Bormaro signing his four-year $11.8 million rookie contract. You can plan on hearing an official announcement from the team on that on Tuesday or Wednesday, and then look for a Bormaro press conference on Wednesday afternoon, I think. So, yes, that's all I have for today. We're officially less than 2 weeks away from training camp. So look for the pod to start slowly ramping up here shortly. Obviously, if the trade does go down, we'll be on that right away. But other than that, we're getting ready for training camp. I'll have Britt on to talk with you all here in the lead up to that. Till then, I'm Dane. Enjoy the rest of your Timberwolves offseason. Peace out. How I'm feeling, man, I hope it never stop, yeah. Green and hot so you can find me in the crowd, yeah, yeah. Don't let standards ever bring you down, yeah. Hope you dancing like nobody else around, yeah. For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.